Welcome to MacGuffin. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website, themacguffin.com, to keep up on our most recent podcasts. We have recently discussed American Vandal, Blade Runner 2049, Dazed and Confused and Everybody Wants Some in the same podcast, as well as Poltergeist. So yeah, check those out. And theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
James.
Yes.
We are here.
Alex.
We have returned from a brief hiatus because the people demanded it.
Back by popular demand.
Exactly. Talking about the biggest movie in America.
That's right.
Yeah.
We're talking about a pretty important movie, actually.
Yeah, for sure.
As far as movies go.
Yeah, it is a notable film from a notable director.
Yeah, Billy Wilder, a director we've talked about before.
A director of note.
Yes. We're talking about Double Indemnity from 1944. Mm-hmm. Your choice? My choice?
I mean, the 100% your choice. I was the one that suggested it as a topic, I think. But, like, in the way that, you know, sometimes you just want to be nice to your friends and give, and since I dictate so many of the episodes of this podcast, you know, like to make you happy every once in a while, you know?
Yeah. In a way, it was American cinema's choice, though. So.
Yes, I think that is true. And I just knew you would never turn down the opportunity to podcast about another movie from the director of Fedora, which is the name of the movie Billy Wilder has directed.
Oh, you know me too well. Well, yeah, it's that's all pretty true. And this is a movie that there's a lot to say about it. There's a lot to know about it, really. And I hadn't seen it until now, and it was it was quite a pleasure to watch.
Yeah, it's a good movie. I will say, I think like a lot of I mean, in with anything that is so historically notable, you know, the things that are highly influential about it, like say the Venetian blind lighting, that's just like, oh, I'm just watching another noir movie, because without researching this movie as somebody watching it in 2017 as opposed to 1944, you don't realize that was new for American cinema. I was just ignorant to it. So with anything that you watch for historical value, some of the luster is just lost just by nature of so many of its good ideas being taken by so many other movies subsequently. So that, you know, it always loses a little bit that way, but it's definitely a very enjoyable film. I enjoyed the lack of presence of a gumshoe, like traditional sort of gumshoe that I kind of anticipated would be in the movie. That's one thing that really stood out to me as like a real positive.
Yeah. Oh, why is that a plus for you?
Just because it surprised me, you know, like Keyes is that playing that role, but he's an insurance investigator, you know. he's not whatever Humphrey Bogart's character's name was in Sam Spade in The Maltese Falcon. Not a guy who is like the gumshoe type, you know. I don't know, it's just a nice little inversion of what I kind of anticipated from a movie that I knew was classified as film noir.
Yeah, no, absolutely. As you said, in some ways, it's too early to be an inversion. Exactly.
But in the order of which I have watched these films, you know, it's an inversion to me.
Yeah, and I think that I really do enjoy that that idea of it too. And I think that as noir kind of gets fleshed out, one of the things it keeps around is this idea of a. I don't know that he's an anti-hero, but just a sympathetic protagonist that is definitely not just all good, you know, and not just a white hat cowboy, if you will. and he's a weird character in a lot of ways. And I think it is interesting that this is so early and it's not a subversion of what's such a trope by this point, because it is so early in noir. And some people say the first noir, but no matter how you cut it, so early on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I like that he is, you know, not just morally, you know, he's obviously responsible. This is kind of a cat and mouse movie, right? This is, in a way, it's Keyes trying to just capture Neff, not really knowing that that's who he's looking for, right?
Yes, and, exactly. Yeah.
And then we also get the more traditional, or the more typical noir plot of you know, a femme fatale and someone kind of attempting to elude that person.
Yes, yeah. One thing I enjoyed about the plot of this movie and the various twists and whatnot that you have to follow as a viewer is that it felt like easier to follow than most noir movies, and I recognize that makes me sound unintelligent, but like in I don't know, in like the Maltese Falcon and stuff like that, it always feels like there's just one sort of plot element, and I can't think of an example off the top of my head, so forgive me for that, but one plot element that just feels like thrown in to add just another layer of intrigue and doesn't really affect anything, whereas yeah. In this movie it's much easier to follow and also just sort of like in a way that just feels tighter, you know, and that was something I really appreciated about it, is how many twists and turns there can be while also you never really lose sight of what's happening and what the real important things are, you know? And I thought that was like a really impressive feat of writing and directing, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely one of, if not the strength of this, is that a lot of things do happen. And if, you know, you chart out the plot and the character discoveries, it does zig and zag a bit, but I kind of get that feeling too with some noirs where you're like, I think I could explain this and why everyone's motivated the way they are about 90%. And I understand why this scene is tense, but maybe I couldn't, you know, do the X's and O's exactly of what every character is doing at this point. But I think this movie, even though a lot happens, I think it takes the audience along with it perfectly. And I think that's, as I said, if not the greatest strength of this, definitely one of them.
Yeah, for sure. And like, and it feels like all of these twists matter in some capacity, whereas I think other movies that we're describing sort of feel like they have twists just to have another twist, you know, or another, yeah, another sort of layer of plot, you know? And that's sort of, that's the thing that I appreciated. It just sort of appealed to somebody that, I mean, of the two of us, you like noir more than I do. I always sort of get caught up more in style and character, I think, than actual like machinations of a mystery. Yeah. So, and I feel like that movie, or sorry, Double Indemnity, played more towards what I want out of a mystery in that way, in that it just didn't, I don't know, it didn't continually try to confuse me with no reason as to why. You know?
Yeah, no, I think it is straightforward. We're following, you know, we're following Neff, and I think that's part of what makes it so easy to follow, is that for the most part we know a lot.
Yes,
you know, this is the cat and mouse, and we're the mouse, and you know, because we are, as much as we're not supposed to like Neff because he clearly acts, I mean, we can debate that in a little bit, but he's definitely not a completely good character fighting for good forces throughout the entire movie, to put it delicately.
Yeah. And even like right off the top, he just like, even regardless of the framing device, like when we first meet him in the chronology of the movie, like within the first 5 minutes of us being with him, he's hitting on a married woman, like pretty openly, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. He just like so much smarm with this dude. Like it's crazy.
Yeah, the reveal of him going to the Dietrichsons the second time when he's leaning on the door frame.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
he's just a sleazeball through. Yeah.
Oh, what? Me? Is your husband home?
Yeah. But as I was saying, you know, this is the guy that, you know, we'll disagree with his moral actions at certain times, definitely. But just because he is our protagonist, he's the character we see the most of. He's first and last on the screen. We relate to him in a way, and we just identify with him the way that Hollywood films have you identify with the person you get the most exposure to and watch the most of the story from their perspective from. Mm-hmm. And it's just interesting how many kind of roles he fills in this movie. You know, he's the one that kind of takes us through this movie. In kind of the noir sense, he's someone who functions inside this machine, but he's also functioning against it. You know, as you said, he's not a private detective. He's not a cop. He's not even the most detective person at the insurance company, right? Mm-hmm. That's Keys. And so he's kind of functioning against the system, but very much a cog in it. And I think that duality is a big part of noir as well. He's the perpetrator of this crime, but also, as we learn, increasingly the victim of this crime. You know, once Lola reveals that Phyllis may have killed the last Mrs. Diedrichsen, and then you know, the younger guy gets involved, and we understand that she's pulling strings all over the place. He's someone who, it's not that we slowly get disillusioned with him, because as you said, right from the get-go, you know, he's kind of slimy and continues to be so, but...
Yeah, and at the halfway mark of this movie, he murders somebody with his bare hands.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not that, you know, he slowly, we slowly start revealing the true nature of him, but... It is still complicated, and we still, as Phyllis becomes more and more clear about who she is, and not that there hadn't been bad female characters in cinema up until this point, but if you think that this is the start of noir, then the idea of the femme fatale and the idea of this woman who uses her sexuality to convince men to do things for her, you know, she's just that much more interesting because she's so prototypical.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And so much of the movie plays out before we sort of realize who's the puppet master, I suppose. You know, it's probably like there's probably only about 20 minutes left before Neff really starts to suspect what's happening. Yeah.
And I think it's also interesting, you know, on that note that you kind of get this idea that they wouldn't have done it alone. You know, we get this idea that Phyllis may have done it before, and she's capable of murder, or at least capable of coaxing someone into murder or letting someone die, mm-hmm. which may have been the case with the first Mrs. Diedrichsen. But I don't know. There's so many things in this movie that I think are so quintessentially noir. And I think that's obviously important because it is, so early on in the chronology of the genre, but that idea that these two people wouldn't be in this mess without each other, like that relationships in general and just coming in contact with other human beings and being attracted to them leads to such darkness. Yeah. I think it's great. And it's not, I don't think that this little bit of dialogue is cheesy, because I think it's just perfect. It definitely could be done the wrong way, but when he says, "I killed for money and for a woman, and I didn't get the money and I didn't get the women," like that is just the genre crystallized into this line that happens pretty early on, and really helped to just win me over right away. And for this to be so early and to do so many of those things in such an interesting fashion, I think is just really impressive.
Yeah, yeah. So, what are some more examples of this type of noir thing that you appreciate in this movie, aside from Neff saying the name Keys 40 million times across the movie?
Man, I mean, you don't even appreciate it the first time through, but just the intro as we see him walking on the crutches.
Oh yeah, well that's great for sure. Yeah,
yeah. That, I mean, the first time you see it, it looks really good.
Yeah.
You know, it's just this cool dynamic shot, and you know, the term film noir, it's definitely the noir is to say something about the darkness of human character, but it's also the visuals are just so important for this genre in a way that it's not necessarily important for other genres or subgenres. And so I think to kind of bring us this image so quickly, that's really arresting just on its own, is interesting, and I think it kind of engulfs you right away. But then when we know what we know by the end of the movie, and you restart it and see that image for what it is, you see that he ends up playing, you know, the role of the husband, and he's the one, you know, he meets the same fate. You know, he acts like this person on crutches, but then he becomes the person on crutches. He acts like Mr. Diedrichsen in order to get the girl, but then he finds out that, you know, he meets the same fate. He's also murdered as a result of his attraction for Phyllis. And mm-hmm. I think that the way that he becomes the husband, and that's done in this interesting visual style before we can have any appreciation for what that is, I think is great. And the voiceover, which, you know, ends up becoming such a staple for noir and something that's mirrored really closely in Sunset Boulevard, another Billy Wilder movie where, I mean, the main character's not dead by the beginning of this movie, but yeah, he has received a fatal gunshot wound and will die about 15 feet from where this movie, where he starts speaking in this movie. Yeah. I think that's really successful. And I think it's this pessimism of noir that, you know, as I touched on, these two people might not have done it by themselves, but they find each other, and just their attraction to each other causes this awful thing to take place. The idea that we meet Neff and he's already a dead man, you know, he's doomed. And as he starts telling his story and he starts confessing, we pity him in a certain way. Obviously, he's invited this into his life, but there is this very dark resignation to where this movie begins, and then we backtrack and we see it play out, and we just experience the what he's gone through for the last little while. Like those tense scenes where he's in Key's office, or in the witness shows up in Key's office, and they start discussing it. It's just having to deal with something that's already happened. It's too late to fix, and now you just have to survive it. I think that's this super dark take on human existence that permeates the genre that I find very, very enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that makes sense. One thing that I really liked that sort of felt like it broke from noir tradition to me was, I mean, we've talked a little bit about the train sequence, but the train sequence felt more like a Hitchcock movie than a real noir movie. And I'm not just saying that because I know, like, I'm aware Hitchcock made Strangers on a Train, you know? yeah. And that is a scene where strangers meet on a train. But, like, I don't know. So it just felt like to watch the Key event. And again, like, as somebody that wouldn't describe himself as a huge noir fan, it feels like in these movies, a lot of the key moments of the actual story don't happen on screen. Whereas this, we get the planning of a crime, we get to watch the execution of the crime, and then we get to watch the fallout of the crime. And it's really structured in this sort of, like, in a pretty the thirds are pretty evenly split that way. And that was something that really felt out of step with noir movies. And again, since that played upon my own expectations for the genre, I really enjoyed that about this movie.
Yeah, and I think that's something we were talking about how easy this is to follow. we get to stay with our one character for the planning, the execution, and the investigation of a crime.
Yeah,
you know, we're so on board with this in a way that we're not getting shoehorned into scenes, and we, you know, we're not with him. I guess we're probably not with him 100% of the movie. There's things where we're not with Neff, maybe, but if they're there, they're pretty rare. You know, we get a pretty good grasp of everything about this movie from one character's perspective, and I think that's what makes it feel so complete and adds to the tension that builds with it, because we watch him experience all of this.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. We watch him experience all of it, knowing where it ends up in Keyes' desk chair at 4:30 a.m. and talking into a dictaphone.
Yeah, and I don't always love the you start with the ending like that, and you know, retrace your steps kind of thing. And I think I've articulated part of why I really enjoy it so much in this one, but it's not something that I always love, and I think it's just done fantastically here.
Yeah, I agree.
And did you read Roger Ebert's review of this?
I don't think I did. No.
Okay. he's trying to trace the motivations of these characters. I don't know. Like, do you sense a lot of love between Phyllis and Neff, or is it just none of the noir men and women ever truly seem capable of love, except like the dead man's wife or something?
Well, I mean, it's just like love in the way that I just always feel is depicted in these movies, where it's just like these two characters meet, they're like, ooh, there's an attraction here, and then it's just like, well, I guess they're in love now, you know? Like, it's just that sort of that distance from the time period that I just have. Like, I don't know what falling in love in 1944 was like, so maybe it was like this. That sounds horrible, you know? But to answer your question with a short answer is no. I do not feel much love between these characters, but I also just don't feel like it was a great period in Hollywood for screen chemistry.
Yeah, it's true, because there are so many of these charismatic figures, but I feel the same way. And I mean, there's a couple things that we can chalk this up to, is that, you know, they have surveys from different generations, and the number of people who expect a romantic love in their marriage is always on the rise, because that just wasn't a big, like, the idea of getting married and finding a partner and having kids and starting a family was just so much more paramount than the idea of having this beautiful poetic love. And so maybe there just was more loveless relationships back then of people who were in the same socioeconomic class of differing genders and were just, you know, available at the time, right? And the other idea is the Hays Code that's in effect. They had either had to jump through hoops to explain in some visual metaphor that sex had taken place, or you just kind of assume that these, you know, post-pubescent adults just have sex and it's clear they're attracted to each other. And they'll say something like, you know, I want to meet her again without that silly staircase in the way, or something like that. And that, you know, that's all it takes. It's like, yeah, okay, so they're physically attracted to each other. Or he'll ask about her anklet enough that it's just implied that they're going to hook up. So that Ebert even says it, you know, maybe they have sex once in this movie, but it's almost impossible to tell in movies from the 40s if they have sex. You kind of just assume that that's what it is. But he says in that review, he says the talking about their motivations and why they did this, and if it's for love or for money or just a bit of excitement or what it is. And he says that the husband's death ends up being their one night stand in this movie, which I think is really funny. You know, and it points out that maybe this plan wasn't great, and maybe their motivations aren't clear. But I also think it sums up something that is so interesting about noir, and it's that intersection of like excitement and violence and sexuality. And I mean, to put all that up in one little package is how many times he says "shut up, baby" in this movie. Like, there just is this weird mix of like violence and sex and love and misogyny, and I don't know, it's just, it's all around. I'm not saying that this is a good thing, but there are just moments where so many of the elements of this genre get just mixed up in these individual moments. And I just think that there's so much in this movie, and I think that's what makes it so interesting. And people talk about this was one of the best movies ever made, or one of the best noirs, and you know, I don't know enough to attest to that, but I just think that it is so so compact and so easy to follow, and does so many of the things that noir was going to be known for so successfully so early in the formation of the genre.
Yeah, and also sort of adds I think what I keep talking about by saying how it subverts my expectations of noir is that it makes a noir movie feel more human. And I think one of the main things I appreciated about this movie is that Neff does something out of passion, right? Like, upon meeting this married woman that he has decided he's in love with, whatever the 1944 version of being in love was. But so that inspires them to do this crime of passion, right? But in order for this crime of passion to work, they have to be really patient and be apart from each other for a long period of time. Like, this movie takes place over, I don't know what, like 6 months? Just we see Neff struggling with the fact that he's mixed up in this crime. He can't remove himself from it, but he 100% is having regrets, not just because of the fact that he has stone cold murdered a person, but in as much as like the passion is probably going to wear off before he's able to get away with it, you know? And I think that is the side of film noir that I think is often missing, that sort of human element. And that is something I enjoyed. Just Neff, even aside from the fact that he committed murder, feeling like he made a mistake and now he's caught up in something that he did for emotional reasons that he can't back out of and feels trapped in. And he just knows he's wrong and he's just got to see it through. You know?
Yeah. And I think that we we gain a lot by him being, you know, neither this gumshoe nor this gangster, right? It's someone we can relate to a bit more. It's just some guy who sells insurance, and then, as you said, the passion gets the best of him and he does something awful, and he probably regrets it on moral reasons, but he also doesn't even get what he wants, right? He did all of this for the money and so that they can be together. And well, now you're not going to have the money. You're not be able to spend any time with her because the police or Keys are surveying this person. And yeah, you've come up with nothing except your life is now just racked with guilt. And anytime you go to work or anytime you get called into the office or anytime you see somebody you may have seen that night, it just completely rattles your ability to enjoy your life.
Yeah. Sorry, were you continuing?
No, well, I just mean with nothing to show for it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and also it's sort of, I mean, no, there's no real attention drawn to this, but you just sort of start to think about what leads Neff to this point in his life where he can make this snap decision that he will murder somebody so that he can be with a married woman. Like what is his life like that that he's willing to get into sort of, or able to get into a mental state where it's just like, yeah, that's a good option, you know? Like, so you just sort of think about him and how he's portrayed in the movie. And outside of his work, before the plot of the murder actually begins, like, he has nothing. He just goes bowling by himself, you know? And there's nothing really in his life other than Keys, who is a friend due to work, you know? And it's just, I think it just paints a picture of, like, a really, just a lonely person who jumps at an opportunity to be with anybody, so much so that he's willing to agree to... co-murder somebody, you know?
Yeah, and I think not just a lonely person, but I think a lonely man, and I think that's I think that's important too. And yeah, as you said, he bowls alone, his
which I mean that might have been a normal thing, you know. You don't have to think too far back to sort of be I mean, it's something we talked about with on Capote, is that the further you go back, the fewer entertainment options there are, you know.
Yeah, I love his hyper-masculine apartment.
Yeah, the boxing pictures.
Shirtless
on the wall.
Boxers and, like, bourbon seems to be the only two things in his home.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think that you're right. We just don't see enough of his life alone, I don't think, to really know that. But, yeah, it leaves you with that question of, you know, there's lust, but you just imagine that in his life he's run into attractive women, you know.
Yes.
that doesn't require this level of work or moral bankruptcy to spend some time with, right?
Yeah, exactly. And he seems like a moderately successful person, and he's handsome, you know. Like, it's just, I don't know, I two qualities that movies from the 1940s have led me to believe are very important in finding a partner, you know?
Well, yeah, and then another thing that we're just not really to separate from the time period, but just getting drunk all the time, seemingly.
Yeah.
But again, we can't read too much into that because that seems to just be happening all the time in this era. But
again, there were fewer entertainment options, so poisoning your liver was higher up on the list.
While driving around Los Angeles.
It was a different time.
Yes, yes, it was.
And also, speaking of poor 1940s decisions, those kids in the street playing baseball are playing baseball in what has to be like the worst. Yeah. Like, that catcher has to be amazing. Like, if any ball goes by him, it's gone forever. You can't even knock on the door and get James Earl Jones to get it from Hercules for you. Like, it's gone.
Yeah, I noticed that too. That was pretty good. Yeah,
that and Neff walking around with apparently just oodles of loose matches in his pocket is just really funny to me.
Yeah. And just so the nonstop smoking, I guess, is another thing that we'll mention on the noir checklist.
Yeah, of course. That's also again the 1940s checklist, though.
That's true.
Yeah.
And we also have the city, you know, just the idea of the city, and more specifically Los Angeles, which is, you know, the epicenter of filmmaking but also of film noir, right?
Yes. Yep. Yeah. And I mean, just the use of darkness, which I don't think we have pointed out, but by 1944 standards, this is, the cinematography in this film is very, very dark, it was uncommon at the time.
Yeah. And to speak about just some of the costume and the design for Phyllis, you know, oh, we meet her You know, she's got the blonde hair. She's wearing a white towel. You know, things are very brightly lit when you first come across her. And she's got, you know, she ends up getting clothes on, and she's got the white clothes and the jewels. And we get this idea that she's really blinded him. You know, she's obviously attractive, but there's also just this brightness. And in a movie that is so dark and so full of shadows, when we get to her, you know, it's daytime, it's sunny. As I said, like the white clothes and the jewelry, just this idea that it's a little too much for him to take in visually, and it blinds him to the moral center that we assume any decent person would have. Mm-hmm. And you know, she comes to his apartment eventually, and we really do start seeing her more shaded in shadows more often, darker clothes. And when they have a drink kind of to consummate this whole notion, the scheme that they're going to go through with, I enjoyed that he had this idea of pink wine for them to share, you know, something very feminine and, you know, literally light and bubbly and colorful. And, you know, she rejects it. She says bourbon will do, which is this, you know, obviously more coded as a masculine drink, literally darker, and just pointing to this underside to her. And obviously she's made herself known to be willing to kill her husband, so there is some obvious darkness there. But I do like that they managed to achieve some of those kind of moral indicators throughout other means than just dialogue and plot points by then.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, again, jumping back to the beginning of Neff's story in the chronology, outside of driving to the house at the beginning, I think the first thing he does is walk into a house uninvited. While he's specifically told he can't come in when the maid answers the door.
Yes, forget uninvited.
Yeah, he's just like a real smarmy Leave Marvin type. Is how Fred McMurray appears to me. Sorry.
Yeah, it's funny to think that he hadn't done anything kind of dark or heavy by this point, was just known for light comedies, because, you know, he is funny, as we said. He does have that, you know, he's smiling a lot. He's doing his own thing. He's having fun. He's getting his way, to put it lightly. But I think he's really good in this.
Yeah, I mean, I think the real MVP of the acting in this movie is Keys. I think he's fantastic.
Yeah. So, and this is shortly after Little Caesar for Edward G. Robinson. So I guess he was kind of reluctant to do a third leading role in this, but mm-hmm. No, he's great, and I think all their scenes together are really good.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely.
Now we just touched on two things that I want to get to. Do you want to talk more about Phyllis, or do you want to talk about Keys and Neff a bit?
I don't know that I have a ton to say about Phyllis, because I think like so much of the characterization of Phyllis is just tied up in all of the femme fatale sort of stylings of a character that it's just like is just like just not a realistic type of character. So it's just a type of character I don't think about all that frequently. Like I don't know, she's just like the things that she does in this movie and is accused of doing in this movie like paint such a nefarious picture that I don't know. There's just nothing in that type of person for me to identify with in any capacity. So I just can't say I have a lot of thoughts about Phyllis because of that, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I just can't see anything that resembles any part of life that I've ever experienced.
Yeah. And if you're going to look at this movie as, you know, you like it because it does show some of the more human things and more realistic elements of existence. I don't think she's the way into that that part of this movie.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, we've probably talked about it a million times on this podcast. Like, when I really fall in love with a movie, it's because some element of it makes me sort of rethink human existence, you know. And there's nothing about this character that of Phyllis that would make me think that, because I think she is the character in this movie who is the least unique from all these film noir tropes. And therefore the least human, because she's the most like a film noir character.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. It's, mm-hmm.
In the same way, like Humphrey Bogart never reflected reality to me.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. I just think it's because of the issue that we've done noir before this, and now we're getting to.
I know. Yeah, that's true.
But I just think that she does what I think that it is interesting that there are so many other, as you're saying, like it's such a trope to have a character like this, and I think that because this one was done so well and achieved a lot of the things that were interesting and unique around the genre, and I think played on some fears of the growing role of women and kind of having this agency and being able to use who they are and use their intelligence and their charisma and their looks in order to get men to do what they want. And so noir is always a mixed bag from a gender perspective, because you know, sometimes these women do awful things, but they at least have agency and mm-hmm. kind of reflect this idea that around World War II, women were replacing men in the workplace. So what was next? You know, what roles were going to shift to them, and what level of decision making, what level of power, and what level of forming morality for the public conscious now that they have a bit more of a stake in it. And so I know what you mean, that it feels like there's not much to say there that we haven't already said about similar characters in other movies. But I just think it's worth pointing out that this was so early on and done so well that you know, imitation is the best form of flattery, right? Like,
yeah,
they did this one so successfully that you can see why we saw so much more of it, that it was done in a way that's interesting for the plot, but also done in a way that's reflective of what's going on societally at the time.
Yeah, for sure. And your point of like the growing agency of women in society, I think is a very valuable one. And but it should be noted that all of that perspective is coming from all of the white men that were still running society. Yeah. And I mean, still continue to now, society and Hollywood in general. Like, you know, it is a new kind of female character, but still one almost entirely depicted by men, you know, with the exception of the woman playing this female character. Yeah.
And as I said, kind of plays on those fears of what a woman who actually forms some kind of ideas about what she wants and enacts them
in a way
that affects everybody around them, no matter what their gender or social status.
Yep, for sure.
Okay, so Keys and Neff.
Yep.
What's going on there?
I don't know.
Okay, so why we've talked about how this begins and ends at the office. Why does he go to confess if he then makes an attempt to escape?
That is a good question. I think my immediate reaction is, after you've been sitting in a chair having been shot hours ago, I don't think the decisions you're making are always like entirely logical.
Okay,
I think he's dealing with such a small percentage of his usual mental capacity at that point that that who knows why? Who knows why anybody does anything at that point? So that's my workaround for not really having an answer to your question.
Okay. Yeah. No, I'm not saying that I see it as a plot hole by any means. I just didn't know because I do think they have an interesting relationship. You know, it is this cat and mouse one, but they clearly admire each other a lot as well. You know, they're adversaries, but after having been friends for a long time, friends and coworkers, and you know, lighting matches for each other, and then, well, actually, it's very one way, and then the other, it's an F lighting matches for Keys for so long, and then the final one, it's been turned around, right?
And I think it's just sort of, I think it part of play why he goes back plays into just the guilt Neff feels, you know, and
that's what I see it as.
Yeah, I like that is for sure the best answer, because you know, he could die in the street somewhere, and then Keys, who has this this stellar record of being able to solve all of these insurance scandals, like he would have a blemish on his record, and Neff has done so much to hinder his own life that he doesn't want to hurt the one friend who hasn't really betrayed him in any capacity in his life. You know, he wants, he's going to die. I think he's aware of that. And he just wants to make sure that, that Keys isn't left with questions, you know?
Yeah. And I think he's just racked with guilt, as you said. Watching, you know, as I said, I think that they're friends. I think they really admire each other. And I think Neff, watching what Keys has gone through, you know, losing sleep, coming out of his place in the middle of the night. I think he just genuinely cares for him. And I think it's a bit of a sincere moment of sweetness in a genre that is typically very lacking in it. You know, Keys, he works very hard at this. And I think that Neff, because of the Hays Code, has to die. So, yeah. You know, we have to have these characters who act outside of what's moral, die. And we have to know that they die as a result of what they've done wrong. So I think if you have to have them die, yeah, having them die out in the street is cold. And at least that the good detective, the person who represents business, represents upright society, you know, the first thing we do is see him catch someone for setting their own car on fire or their own truck on fire to get the insurance money. This stable force of, you know, it's a force of honesty, but it's also capitalism and business and all these very positive things are, you know, they get their comeuppance. They, in the end, they always win, and they get to light the match. They get told that they love them. They get to, you know, watch even though it's his friend, he gets to see the person who has done wrong die in front of him, mm-hmm. as a reward for his, you know, his hard work and his morality.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I just want to point out the elevator shot at the beginning of this movie when Neff is in the elevator going up right before he goes to the dictaphone initially.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just the way that they walk into an elevator and then walk out on a different floor. That's just awesome. It's 1944. Obviously, they're not moving the elevator. They just wheeled a wall of set out of the way so that they could then be on the office set. But that's just a very creative shot for 1944. And I just found that very, very stylish and very, very uncommon for the time period. And I felt like it needed to be mentioned, because one thing that I think is consistent through all the Billy Wilder films that I've seen is that they always feel more modern than the year they were actually released in. And I think that's always the real sign of a really talented director. I mean, the king of that is Stanley Kubrick. Like, you watch Dr. Strangelove and it looks like a movie that was released in 1989, you know, like it's amazing. And Billy Wilder has a little bit of that in how he makes his movies as well.
Oh, he knows more trick than a carload of monkeys, that guy.
he used to do his cinematography sober, and then he put some rum in it and got it on his feet.
Anything visually that we did miss? Like, is it mostly just again kind of giving this the short shrift because of getting to it?
First
after talking about things that it totally inspired, but.
Yeah, I there's not a ton in it that really jumped out at me as super inventive. I think the way that the opening credit shot, as you said, the crutches silhouette, that shot, and then that same shot is mirrored on the train as he's walking towards the back of the observation car. Like, that's a really good, like, mirroring, especially since, as you said, it sort of shows the duality. Like, there are two people that are these men on crutches, you know, and that we see that shot two different times in two different situations is cool.
And they'll meet the same fate.
Yeah, exactly. That I think there are some exterior shots in this movie that I always feel obligated to point out. We're done at a time when exteriors, like, not in a studio, were not done very frequently, you know, like the car driving through the streets at the very beginning as Neff's going to the office, like, just nighttime exteriors, that's just so uncommon. Because it was just so difficult, like the limitations of film stock and the amount of power you need to light something like that
on location in LA.
Yeah, exactly. Those are just difficult things that We talked a lot about it on Sunset Boulevard, how there's some location shooting right at the beginning that's borderline staggering given the time period. And I think this should be pointed out for the same reason.
Yeah, and in that intro, one of the cars he almost hits while he's speeding is from the Los Angeles Railway Department. Just a little indication of something else that's going to play a huge part in this movie.
Yep, yep.
And Billy Wilder is the one who... Did you hear the story about the car not starting?
Yes.
Plot point?
Yes, I did.
So I guess after switching out the bodies and starting up the car, it was meant to drive away, and I guess they shot that scene and they were kind of, you know, tearing down and everyone was heading home, and Billy Wilder gets in his car, which doesn't start, and he thinks that this would be an awesome thing to happen in the movie. So he tells everybody to get back inside and they shoot that. And I think it's a great little moment, and this movie would be almost as good without it. But just that last little bit, like just one more thing to kind of tighten the screws. And you start thinking about, well, you know, what this means, how they can explain it, what happens if they get found at this moment, how does that change things? Mm-hmm. And it's just that much more tension, which I think is great.
Yeah, absolutely. So while we're talking kind of about Billy Wilder specific things,
yes,
I'm just curious to know, because for the listener that doesn't know a lot about Billy Wilder had an amazingly varied career. Like if you look at his filmography, there are so many movies you've heard of and so many movies in vastly different genres that you have heard of. And
Fedora.
Yeah, I mean, his last really notable movie is The Apartment in 1960, I think it was. But it's like The Apartment, Some Like It Hot, Witness for the Prosecution, Double Indemnity, Sunset Boulevard, who knows what else I'm forgetting, but like that's just five off the top of my head. And I'm curious to know who you think the closest to a modern equivalent of Billy Wilder is. Because I think Mike Nichols was the next generation's version of Billy Wilder, to much less success. But like Mike Nichols, his highs were borderline as high as Billy Wilder's highest highs. But like as a career on the whole, I think there were a lot more down periods in Nichols' career than there was for Wilder. I'm just curious to know if you can think of a modern version of him.
That's tough because you need, I think, like what you're saying is that variety, right? Like,
yeah.
Some Like It Hot and the kind of lighter fun comedies to something like this, which is, you know, so dark and heavy and claustrophobic. No, that's a good question. After Nichols, because yeah, he would have had that variance too, right?
Yeah, Nichols has an awesome career. Like, as somebody who has pretty recently watched almost all of his movies, fantastic career.
Yeah, no, but I'm trying to think of someone who, I mean, he has that comedic element as well as mm-hmm. some good dramatic chops. I don't know. I can't think of a good modern one. I think people kind of get a little more in their lane now, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
Is there one?
I didn't have an answer when I posed this question, but as we've been talking about it, I thought of it. It's Steven Soderbergh. I think that's the closest example we've got. And somebody who has excelled in a high number of genres, is widely regarded to be super talented, and also enjoys working within genre and playing with it in a way that's inventive, you know? And that's my answer.
Yeah, based on
and variety. Also that's also my answer to most questions about directors. I just want to talk about Steven Soderbergh, I guess. But
no, this one is unforced, though. I will give you that. That's pretty good.
He's also like, he is the only director in Hollywood of his age that has a varied career, you know? Yeah. So
and just, man, there's so much to read about with this movie, too. If you want to hear some great Billy Wilder / Raymond Chandler stories, then watch Double Indemnity and then read about it.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of, like, really 1940s quotes as well, like, which is just always fun. Like, pretty much anything, any sort of quote about the making of this movie that ends in an exclamation point, I read as a Carnival Barker, in a Carnival Barker sort of voice, and just makes it so much more fun.
Yeah, if you want to read about drinking during the day and getting upset because people are wearing hats inside, still, some Double Indemnity history is for you.
That actually sounds like our college experience of living together. Me getting mad at you wearing a hat indoors.
Oh man, tripping somebody at the Oscars, pretty cool, eh?
Oh, power move. Yeah, no, that's I forget the name of the director, but the director who ended up winning Best Director this year when Billy Wilder thought he would win it.
That's I couldn't imagine something like that happening, but I think it'd be so great.
Yeah, well, the joke is on that director whose name I can't remember because I remember Billy Wilder's name.
You idiot.
Yep. Do you have anything more to add about Double Indemnity?
No, I don't think so. I think it was a lot of fun. And I think as we've said, like, it's one of those ones that, you know, I think you said it best, that when to watch it without knowing how much of this was pioneered is to do it a disservice. And it was kind of like the Seinfeld is not funny concept, right? That thing we talked about where if you weren't around to experience it the first time, which we weren't, it's difficult to appreciate just how much of this hasn't been seen up until now or hadn't been done in this way up until now. And just how much is owed to someone who wrote a great novel and someone who wrote a great screenplay and some good performances and a like great cast and crew and director.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess one last thing to point out is just Alfred Hitchcock was a big Billy Wilder guy. And I think it's worth noting just because, you know, the Hitchcock that we sort of start to, like, the Hitchcock that we remember, his career doesn't really functionally start until after 1944. You know, Spellbound's 1945, and all of his most famous movies come after that. You know, like, there are movies that he makes before then that everybody regards as really great. Shadow of a Doubt's probably the best example of Hitchcock's early movies.
But it's not Hitchcock in the way that we think of, you know, Hitchcockian films.
Exactly. It's not like Psycho Hitchcock or Rear Window Hitchcock. And he was a huge Billy Wilder fan. And that this middle section, especially the stuff on the train, which I know I've mentioned already, but I think it bears mentioning again, feels so Hitchcockian. I think it's just worth pointing out because Alfred Hitchcock is, like, at worst, the second most famous director of all time. I think it bears mentioning how clear it is that Billy Wilder had a huge influence on him.
Yeah, and he would tell you that himself.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Man, and be sure to check back next time.